Hello, welcome to Paranormal is Normal. This is Richard Allibone on webtalkradio.net, and this week we'll be talking about dreaming and trance. We all dream several times each night, and we may remember the last one. Personally, I don't even do that, but my guest tonight studied his own dreams over several years and realized that there was a pattern, and it was this. Dreams are always about something emotional that happened during the day. But this is the point. They are about the emotion, not about the people or the place, but about other people and in some other place. Dreams are like this to clear the emotional problem, but at the same time putting it in the proper instinctive content. The guest I have today is psychologist and therapist Joseph Grippin. He lives in Ireland, near Dublin, and his revolutionary theory of dreaming has been put to very good use all over the world. It is used in the treatment of psychological illness. Hello, Joe. There's lots of theories of dreaming which led towards the idea that it was all to do with instinctive behavior. I wonder if you could tell us how instinctive behavior patterns affect our dreams.
Well, the mystery of dreaming, as you know, has been around for thousands of years, but it's really only in the last 50 years that enough physiological understanding of what's going on has become available to be able to put forward a fairly coherent picture about what's actually happening in dreams. And the key to everything is the REM state. The rapid eye movement state is the state in which the vast amount of dreaming takes place. But the vast amount of dreaming takes place in the REM state. But the REM state actually exists and predominates in the life of the fetus inside its mother's womb. And at that particular period of time, the REM state is being used to program in instinctive behavior. So that, for example, newborn babies are born and they're able to smile. They're able to make all kinds of sophisticated facial expressions. They have already programmed with a repertoire of behavior to enable them to engage the world. Now, dreaming is a process that evolved to protect that instinctive learning so that for about 2 hours every night in our sleep, we return to the REM state to correct, as it were, and to restore to pristine condition our instinctive knowledge. What happens very simply is this, is during the daytime, for a variety of reasons, emotional instinctive impulses may have to be suppressed. Perhaps we get angry and it's not a good idea to tell your boss off in the middle of a recession. So we suppress that impulse. Or maybe you're a middle-aged woman and you see an attractive young man go past your desk and you remind yourself, well, I shouldn't be having those sorts of thoughts, and you repress that impulse. Now, if those instinctive impulses were to accumulate day after day, two consequences would follow. One, we become like headless chickens, distracted with so many conflicting impulses. But number two, the repeated inhibition of instinctive impulses eventually would tie our instincts up in so many inhibitory knots that we would lose access to them. So in our dreams at nighttime, the brain is taken offline because the body becomes paralyzed. We release the suppressed instinctual impulses and they are acted out through pattern matching or metaphor, which releases the suppressed emotions, restores our instincts to their pristine condition, and we wake up much de-stressed and ready to face the next day.
So that's in a nutshell, that's why we dream. And it's
indeed,
it's all about the instinctive behavior, basically.
Yeah, it's preserving that instinctive knowledge.
Yes, and that
absolutely
that instinctive knowledge gets into our dreams.
Indeed, it gets expressed when it's suppressed. It's expressed, as it were, through our dreams.
Yeah.
It keeps those instinctive programs intact.
Yeah. Does that dreaming have anything to do with what's happening during the day or the day or so
before? Oh, yes.
Before?
It's all got to do with what's happening. It's all got to do with what's happening during the day, Richard. During the daytime, stuff happens. We have an instinctive emotional response to it. A lot of the time, we can act out those instinctive responses, and there's an end to it. But when, for whatever reason, we have to suppress those instinctive responses, then those instinctive responses are kept on hold until we go into the REM state at nighttime. Then they're released and acted out through metaphor or pattern matching. which releases the suppressed emotions. So it's all got to do exactly with what's happening during the daytime. Whatever matters that we get upset about, are excited about, positively or negatively, and we're unable to follow through on them, they become the subject matter of dreams.
Yeah, I believe it's the emotion which is sort of impinged
emotion is the key to everything. Yes, you see, the thing of it is, for many decades, psychologists weren't allowed to use the word instinct in psychological research. It wasn't acceptable for political reasons. And so we just talked about emotions. But essentially, emotions and instincts are the same programs.
Mm.
They're an anger emotion, an anxiety instinct, or an anxiety emotion, a sexual instinct, or a sexual emotion. Of course, we have physical ones like hunger and thirst as well. But essentially, it's all instinct.
Mm. Now, a lot of people think that dreaming is about predicting the future. There's lots of books which tell you how to predict the future from your dreams. Mm. I'm sure you don't agree with that.
Oh, well, you see, the thing is, we mustn't be too black and white. The dream state evolved to enable us to act out unexpressed emotional expectations. But that REM state was the original programming state of the brain. And if our brains are capable of connecting to other dimensions of reality, then it is very plausible that the REM state could be the portal through which such connections could be made. And there is such strong anecdotal evidence that people at times access information about the future that I personally do not rule that out at all. And I don't see it in any way contradicting our dream theories, but merely an extension of them.
That's a good way of looking at that. Now, I believe you were able to explain some well-documented dreams of Freud and Jung.
That's correct, yes.
Which they had not been able to explain. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Freud said that he would see psychoanalysis fall or stand on the basis of one dream that he thought was all important. He called it his specimen dream, the dream of Irma's injection. And he gave a very, very long, convoluted explanation for this. However, in the 1960s, letters became available that showed exactly what Freud was doing the night before he had that dream and the specific emotional matter that was on his mind, which was a complex case history that had run into difficulties. And I was able to show in the book that his dream exactly paralleled that case history, step by step, to such a degree that a physicist and a philosopher of science, whose wife happened to be a therapist, passed the book to him in which I explained this. And he just read my explanation and Freud's dream and said, I don't need to read any further. It is so improbable that this could be due to coincidence that the theory has to be right. He said it's like reading a passage in French and a passage in English, Freud's case history and what the dream content was. Equally at Jung had written a dream that he felt revealed the collective unconscious, and he attached huge power to it. And again, we were able to look at the matters that were concerning him the previous day and show in the book that was a complete symbolic representation for what he'd been emotionally concerned about the previous day.
Yeah, so that's a great proof of your theory then, isn't it?
So now, Joe, in this segment of my show, I'll discuss what you've been saying and also what I hope you'll tell us later. Joe Griffin examined his own dreams, discovering that there was a strange pattern between the dream and some recent experience he'd had generally the day before. And this was that our dreams are related to the emotional part of the previous experience, but in a different context to that previous experience. As an example, I'm going to quote from Joe's book about one of his dreams. He said, "I start to climb the castle wall. As I get nearer to the top, I notice that stones are coming loose and falling down. I feel myself to be in great danger of serious injury." Now, that was a rather strange dream to have. But then he remembered that during the day he had been thinking about a memory from childhood. He went on to say, In this memory, I was playing ball, and the ball bounced over a boundary wall. I ran to climb the wall and get it back, but as I pulled myself up, a stone came loose in my hand, and I fell backwards. Unfortunately, the stone followed me, making a large gash in my forehead that required medical attention. Then he continued, "The dream can be seen as a pictorial representation of part of my earlier thoughts. There were, however, some significant changes made in the dream images. The boundary wall, which in reality was just a few feet high, was changed in the dream to a castle wall. The single stone that had come away in my hand was changed in the dream to the entire castle wall beginning to collapse." Joe discovered that all his dreams were related in this rather obscure way to something that had happened during the day, so that if something similar happens in daily life, then we unconsciously know how to deal with it. This, of course, is updating our instinctive bank of memories, which is now the main object of dreaming. On the face of it, this is such a simple and small step forward, but in reality, it's a giant leap forward in the understanding of instinctive behavior and emotion. Also, of course, the understanding of what dreams are all about. The rapid eye movement, or REM, that is observable during dreaming, is an indication of the trance state of dreams, but it is also observable when we go into trance during the day. It's been found that before a child is born, it spends a significant part of its day in REM, which for me indicates that it is receiving instinctive information by some process similar to telepathy from other members of the species. Although proof of this argument is hard to find, how else could instinctive information get into our brain, I ask. I asked Joe about knowledge of the future coming into dreams. In other words, can dreams predict the future? He was not at all dismissive of this idea and suggested that the REM state is the way that people access information about the future. For me, this comes about by the same telepathic link that gives us all instinctive information. It seems that the parts of the puzzle seem to be fitting together like a jigsaw puzzle. For instance, many years ago, they spent several years testing telepathy during dreaming and proved that telepathic messages can be sent to a person in REM sleep. These tests in a dream laboratory at Maimonides were quite conclusive, so precognitive dreaming cannot be ruled out. We only have to hear the reports of people that dreamed of 9/11 before it happened to realize that they could have received some sort of emotional thought vision from one of the people who carried out that atrocity. Anyway, back to Joe Griffin. I believe, Joe, your findings about dreaming went on to say important things about hypnosis and trance.
You see, the test of any really true scientific idea, I believe, is does it go on to have further ramifications? Because if something is really, really revealing true about nature, it should be almost like a diamond with many facets and should connect up to reality in lots of different ways. And so something that is true will have such an explanatory power. And certainly this explanation of dreaming gives for one, it goes in multiple directions to explain depression and psychosis, but one of the directions it goes in is to give the first coherent scientific explanation for what hypnosis is. There have been many theories of hypnosis, but once we realize that the REM state is like a theatre in which dreaming takes place. The REM state is separate from the dream process. Then it's possible for people to access that REM state whilst they're awake. And that's essentially what hypnosis is. It's accessing the REM state. And all the magical and weird properties that one ascribes to hypnosis can actually be shown to be the properties of the dreaming brain. For example, if people go deeply into hypnosis, they may feel they can't move their body. Well, our bodies are actually paralyzed whilst we dream at nighttime. A lot of forgetting is associated with dreaming. People in deep levels of hypnosis can often forget what they've actually experienced. People can experience conditions where they can be operated on under hypnosis and feel no pain. Well, in the dream state at nighttime, the sensory apparatus is cut off so that we don't actually feel pain whilst we dream, and so on. So that the properties which hitherto have been unexplainable about hypnosis are readily understandable once you realize they are the common everyday properties of the REM state.
Yes, I'm wondering, I was interested in trance and all the different mm-hmm. aspects of trance. And it seems to me that it is just an inhibiting mechanism. That is the main thing about trance. And of course, this is it inhibits consciousness. And during a dream, of course, consciousness doesn't come into it. Consciousness is switched off. And it's just the sort of imagination runs wild and in a way sort of led by instinctive programs. I wondered if you look upon trance as a consciousness inhibiting mechanism.
I think you put your finger on something really important, but I need to make a distinction. So consciousness in the sense of self-consciousness, it is inhibiting self-consciousness, which is a property really of the higher cortex, or at least accessed by the higher cortex. One can have lower levels of consciousness in which one is aware of sensory stimuli, but self-consciousness is inhibited in trance. And you're absolutely right. The function of that is to allow the expression of instinctive behavior, particularly in situations that could be interfered with self-consciousness. For example, if a sudden danger presented itself, like a hungry lion charging at one, the last thing you want to do is to be going into logical analysis about the consequences. What you need is to be able to cut out self-consciousness completely and allow the instinctive brain to take over and go into either fight or flight, whichever is the best possibility for one. So trance is about cutting out self-consciousness so that instinct can express itself for sure.
Yeah, and of course in the sexual drives we have, we go in when we're thinking about sex, we see a woman, you know, we go mm-hmm. into a trance state, and consciousness is somewhat inhibited. We don't think about the ramifications and so on. We just tend to act in an instinctive way where consciousness is
indeed, a lot of the sexual problems that I and other therapists, for example, would deal with arise because people are becoming self-conscious in the act of lovemaking. This can happen, for example, if a man has been out of a relationship for a number of years and now becomes very self-conscious about his lovemaking. And because he's becoming self-conscious, he's not going into trance, and that's actually inhibiting the instinctual response. And hence he comes for help. So yes, you're absolutely right. That is an instinctive response. And if we become too self-conscious, it inhibits the response.
Yes. And my theory, of course, is that we evolved trance in order that sexual and other instinctive patterns of behavior could be carried out okay. Mm-hmm. And this high level of trance had to be evolved as consciousness evolved. So we evolved trance as we evolved consciousness, which was 70,000 years ago. And that's mm-hmm. that's a theory which I've been working on, and I think I'm right.
Well, I certainly think that they complement each other. That we have to have that as humans we need the ability to step out of trance and go into a bigger field of more dispassionate awareness in order to be able to plan intelligently and see the bigger picture. But to do anything well, we have to be able to step out of that bigger picture of self-consciousness and into trance. So I think they're two complementary processes.
Mm. And of course, this instinctive behavior business is very like the reactions we see to post-hypnotic suggestions. So a hypnotist
exactly
suggests
right.
something.
I'm sure you're absolutely right. If we can see that hypnosis is getting a person into the REM state was originally the programming state for instinctive behavior, and those instincts are fired off when the appropriate stimulus appears in the environment. So that if we give a post-hypnotic suggestion to somebody that when they see the letter red, they'll feel a certain reaction pattern, well, then that is exactly mimicking an instinctive behavior, post-hypnotic suggestion. Mm. And you're going to trance. Mm. We're going to trance to carry out instinctive behaviors.
Mm. And this leads on to the big question as far as you're concerned. What has an understanding of hypnosis to do with treating mental problems? And this you put to good use over the years, I believe.
Yes. Well, about 20 years ago, myself and some other colleagues working in the field of therapy were really dismayed that the single most powerful tool in psychotherapy, which is hypnosis, was not being used by the majority of psychologists, the majority of psychotherapists or counselors. They were scared of this tool, partly because there wasn't a scientific explanation for it, and partly because of all of the sort of magical, mystical type associations with hypnosis, scared people away from it. And a significant part of what our work was to rehabilitate hypnosis. And as part of that process, in fact, we found that when working, say, in the health service in Britain, it just got account executives and things a bit wary if you even mentioned the word hypnosis. So actually, we use the term guided imagery, which they think, oh, the guided imagery, that sounds very benign. That can't certainly be doing anything. And so they found that term much more acceptable. But we have placed the use of guided imagery or hypnosis at the heart of good psychotherapeutic practice. It is a tool. It's not a therapy. It is a tool which, when used with the appropriate psychological knowledge, can greatly accelerate recovery from depression, anxiety states, etc. It's a hugely powerful psychotherapeutic tool.
Yes, and I suppose you used that yourself to start with as a therapist, which was your job.
Absolutely.
And then gradually, it went on to training other people to use system.
That system within the overall formulation which we developed, which was called human given psychotherapy, predicated on the simple notion that all living things have needs, be they a sunflower or be they a human being. And if those needs are adequately met, then the human being or the sunflower thrives. In the case of human beings, there are emotional and physical needs, and it's mainly emotional needs that have been somehow stymied. And when we remove the barriers to those emotional needs being met, people recover extraordinarily fast from all types of emotional difficulties. And one of the tools that we use in helping to remove the barriers is, of course, hypnosis.
Yeah. And you set up a system for training therapists in the UK, which was called Mindfields College. And and this is really spread around. I wonder if you could tell us give us a list of the problems that are treatable
by human givens therapy. We now call it the Human Givens College. Human Givens therapy routinely deals with problems like clinical depression, panic attacks, anxiety states, agoraphobia, addictions, and it also is now being increasingly used for illnesses such as psychotic illnesses and autism. Because the basic idea is, you see, if needs are not being met, it doesn't matter what level of ability or disability you have, one still has the same emotional needs. And having an understanding of those emotional needs and what constitutes barriers gives one the most effective approach to helping these myriad of conditions. And we've now trained more than 1,000 therapists in the UK in this approach, and tens of thousands of people have attended seminars and workshops. The books, my co-writer, Ivan Tyrrell, and myself have written 6 best-selling books, which sell right across the world. I was in New York recently, and I could see them in Barnes & Nobles, for example. So they sell right across the world. But our main starting point has been here in the UK. It's true.
Mm. Yes. Well, it's nice to hear that that you've been able to promote your book and the ideas around the world. And what I find is quite amazing is that it all stemmed from your analysis of dreaming, and then the book you wrote, The Origin of Dreams, the book you wrote a good many years ago.
Indeed, that is true. And that is true. But I suppose in so far as that is true, and it is true, we ought to give some credit to Sigmund Freud, because he first highlighted the whole importance of dreaming. And he had it half right when he said dreams are wish fulfillments. They're more about emotional expectation fulfillments. But he was on the right track, and he certainly started us on the right track.
Mm. And you've written quite a few books, in many in conjunction with Ivan Tyrrell. One I have in my hand is a little book entitled Hypnosis and Trance States. Only a little book, but it says an awful lot about hypnosis and trance, which has intrigued me for many years. And I very often look at this little book. Perhaps you could tell us a list of the books that have been published about
Right. Well, the Origin of Dreams was the first book that I wrote, and then with my writing partner Ivan Tyrrell, we went on to write a book called Human Givens, which has sold tens of thousands of copies all around the world, which gives a basic understanding of the psychology and what human emotional needs are. And then we went to write a series of self-help books, which have been bestsellers, about how to get out of depression fast, how to lift anxiety fast, how to break addictions, how to control your anger. And we have a new book coming out in August, which takes our ideas a step further. And it's actually called Godhead and the Brain's Big Bang. And that's being released on the 1st of August.
I haven't read any of the subsequent books apart from Human Givens. I have a
All
copy,
right.
Which I found a little technical, because of course it's written for therapists. It's a rather
technical book. The self-help books are written for a different audience. Indeed, GPs in England often actually give the book How to Lift Depression Fast to patients instead of actual tablets, because they find that the information there is so accessible and so practical that a great many people, once they have access to what they need to do, they can actually get themselves out of depression.
Yeah.
One of the key things, by the way, for getting people out of depression is the dream mechanism. When we get depressed, we worry an awful lot, which causes agitation in the autonomic and in the instinctive brain. And that leads to excessive dreaming. And just as two Aspros will lift a headache, but if you take the bottle of them, it'll kill you. Same way, if we worry too much, we dream too much, and that totally demotivates the brain and zaps it. And that's why depressed people wake up so tired in the mornings. So one of the key pieces of advice to a depressed person is to focus their mind outwards with doing stuff in the environment. Stay off the worry circuit. You will dream less and wake up feeling better.
Well, Joe, I must thank you so much for that. It was almost revealing and interesting, and I'm sure our people on Web Talk Radio will enjoy listening to what you've had to say. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks, Richard.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, Nat. Bye.
So, as you will have realised, my guest has done a great deal around the world in helping individuals and therapists to cure the whole range of those mental problems that the human race is prone to. These problems are due to the REM and a powerful trance mechanism that inhibits logical thinking when we're in trance, making a mental problem self-perpetuating. Our guest's been able to explain not only the origin of dreams, trance and hypnosis, but also the reason that so many people drift in and out of trance during the day, which they are unable to do anything about. I hope this problem may help some of those people to see that there is a light at the end of the dark tunnel, and that there is an explanation for the darkness. Dreaming, hypnosis, and trance may no longer be considered as paranormal. They are normal human attributes. I hope you found my program interesting, and that you'll continue to realize paranormal is normal. This is Richard Allibone signing off on webtalkradio.net for this week. Thanks for listening.